The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening, everyone. And can you hear okay? Maybe a little bit louder. Can we do it? Let's see. How's it now? Is that better? Does that work better? Good. So, good evening again. I think that it's relatively normal or maybe natural or something that when people encounter a new religion, like if you haven't grown up with Buddhism, get interested in Buddhism as a new religion, that one of the common directions people take to understand a religion that's not their own is to go look at the tenets of the religion, the beliefs of the religions, the philosophy, something. And there's nothing wrong with that approach, but it's probable that beliefs and philosophies and tenets and creeds are not that important for most religious people. Or say it differently, that what's important for most religious people is the stories of their religion. And the stories that they're told about their religion, the stories they live. And often people, many people who live in religious tradition are sharing particular stories which are inspiring, meaningful, evocative. Those stories might speak to the teachings of the religion. They might express them or somehow. But there's more in a story than teachings. There's often a relationship people have with the story that's different than teachings. People are somehow they identify sometimes with the story. They can sometimes use a story to mirror or reflect or think more deeply about their own life and their life story. They can identify with the characters in the story, and you know, because there's a story, sometimes there's some emotions to it. There's a plot and that's exciting or meaningful or. And so in studying religions, and I have a degree in religious studies, one of the interesting approaches to understand religion is not their beliefs, but rather the stories people tell. And so what are the stories that Buddhists tell? And what are the important stories? So I'll tell you those in a few moments, a couple of them. But before I do that, I'd like to also suggest that human beings, people, are to a great extent storytellers. And we tell our own story. And we have a story about our life, a story about the life of people we're involved in, of our society, of our community, of our world. And we tell these stories. And some of those stories are accurate enough. Some of them, we've learned later, maybe weren't so accurate. Or the stories are, anytime you tell a story, the story has, I think, a bias, leaves out some things and includes other things or emphasizes something over something else. Today I was telling a friend some stories about my own life, and it was a series of things that have happened to me over my life that I was tying together. And I can't recall ever taking these particular events and tying them together. They had common elements to them, so it made some sense. But it never occurred to me to kind of tell my story from that way. So I told a new story about myself. Story, and you know, I'm 58 years old, right? So some of this had to do when I was quite young. And what am I? You know, what meaning? It's a story I haven't told myself before. It happened to me, these things, you know, so it's not like I made up a story. But is this, you know, is this a relevant story for me, or why? How's it relevant? Is it interesting to see my life in a new perspective from this particular angle? And do I emphasize some things more than others? Why did I emphasize those parts of the story and not other parts of the stories? And then recently I went back, this summer I went back to a city that I grew up in for 5 years as a child. I hadn't been back in almost 40 years. And I was fascinated to be there. And this town, this city, it was, I thought I had the run of the town. I knew the town really well, and I did know parts of the town really well, like back of my hand. But I was surprised that just a few blocks away from the center of town, I didn't know the town. I went in a very small section of town. And so I told her a whole story about my life around that built up around this town, where I lived and what I did. And I thought, you know, a story involved knowing the town. And turns out I only knew, I don't know what, but a tenth of the town, this little sliver through downtown and the outskirts going to where we lived. So it's a story, right? And then, you know, and then you have stories which don't have, maybe even don't have dramatic plots to them, but stories like, you know, I'm not enough. I'm not good enough. I'm great. And people don't recognize how great I am. I've had this terrible thing happen to me, and now I'm stuck this way forever. And there's all these stories, ideas, concepts we have about ourselves that we tell ourselves over and over again. Or our politicians tell us stories. And they tell the same story over and over again with a certain kind of emphasis. And so we live in that story, and you laugh, but you know, it's almost subliminal in ways in which a collective society tells stories, and we incorporate them, stories of inside and outside. And it's really dramatic in times of war, where we tell, you know, people, probably every nation's in war, will tell stories sometimes about the other people, the enemy, so-called enemy, that's quite demonizing of them. And then later they meet or in different circumstance and they can become friends. So we tell stories, we're storytelling. And so I think it's very important to both take responsibility and understand the nature of stories and how we tell stories. But I think it's also a rich and important part of life to participate in the stories, to live in the stories, to tell ourselves some of these stories. But not to get stuck in them, but in ways that the stories can help free us, can benefit us, can improve us as people, as a society. And so what are those stories? So Buddhism has its stories that are meant to free us, because liberation and freedom is really important for Buddhism. They're meant to point to some of the truths that Buddhism thinks are very important for our lives, and points to the possibility of human development and growth, improvement. So some of the beautiful qualities of the human heart can come to the forefront. Compassion, for example, is one of them. So there are stories about compassion, which are quite common. So the classic story in Buddhism is a story of the Buddha's life. And that's one of the stories that Buddhists tell over and over again. And in every telling of a story, it's a new story, even though you heard this before. And so I said, you know, that religious people, you know, stories are really important for people in religions, and they tell themselves stories or they're part of stories, even if they're not consciously thinking, that's what I'm doing, I'm aligning myself with a story, they're still involved with stories. But perhaps it's a little bit more subtle. Maybe what's important is not story, but storytelling. And so to participate in a religion is to participate in a tradition of storytelling, whether it's the Dharma teacher or the minister who's sermonizing and telling a story, or whether it's you yourself repeating a story, both to your friends perhaps, but also to yourself. You go home from hearing a story or reading a story, and then it starts working you a little bit. And you review it, you reflect on it, you think about it, and you use it as a kind of reference point for your life. In fact, it's possible that, for many religious people, what makes them religious is not necessarily that they believe in something, but what makes them religious is they keep referring back to certain stories as a reference point for their lives. And over and over again. And so to just kind of read a story, I know that story, that makes sense, and then not think about it anymore. Maybe that's kind of limiting your engagement with a religious tradition. But to hear a story, engage and reflect and think about it is part of what it means to be religious. So I have this chaplaincy training program I'm involved in teaching. Some of you have been in it. And one of the aspects of this training program, training people to be involved in offering spiritual care to others, is every month we give them a Buddhist story. And most people who do the program have never been trained or learned how to consciously, intentionally live with a story for a month, reread it many times, maybe once a day or something, reread it, reflect on it, grapple with it, imagine your characters in the story, imagine how you would respond if you were different characters in the story. Can you see yourself in the story? In what way has your life, even though story might be idealized and it's very dramatically different than your story, your life, can you find ways in which a story has played out in your life? Have you been some of the characters in the life, in the story? And it's very fascinating over the course of the year of teaching the chaplaincy training program to watch how the students' inner life seems to deepen as they grapple with these stories and live with the stories and go with them. So this is a way of saying that perhaps it's not the story of a religion that's important, but the storytelling that we tell ourselves and we're part of. Is this making some sense? Kind of a different kind of approach, right, to what we usually do here. So now I want to tell you the stories. And so this is a storytelling. It's a storytelling in a particular way. July 2012. Is it a traditional Buddhist story? Just because I'm telling it? Can you go back to some of the Buddhist scriptures and say, well, that's not what the story says. This is the true story back there. They're all stories. Someone made up a story. Someone was telling a story. Some stories are more true and more connected to reality than others. Some are more myths than others. I suspect that if a high percentage of the stories around the Buddha could be called myths. So because they're myths, then we don't live those stories. We only want stories that are really what happened true. So stories, you know. So how do we live? How do we find ourselves in it? So the value of the stories I'm going to tell today are not found in the stories themselves, but are found if you pick them up to grapple with them, to reflect on them, to tell yourself these stories, find yourself in the story in some way. That's where the value is, not just the telling of it. Not to be inspired by it. That's valuable a little bit. Or not to be underwhelmed by it or say, that's a terrible story. That's, you know. You're welcome to that as well. But in both situations of being inspired and being turned off by the story, you lose an opportunity. And the opportunity is for you to enter into deeper into what's going on for you. Why did you respond and react to the story this way? Why did it touch you, you know, positive, negative? What's going on for you to understand, to grapple, go deeper? And perhaps are there other dimensions of the story that I'm ignoring when I get inspired? Are there other dimensions that I'm ignoring when I turned off by the story? It's fascinating, this chaplaincy training program. Some people in the beginning of the program especially will write, I don't like this story. And basically that's all they say. It's not very transformative for anybody just to say, I don't like it. And they have to be trained. They have to hold their hand and say, you know, you have to, you know, what you need to do is kind of explore why you don't like it and what is it about the story you don't like? And can you look around your preferences and look around your dislike and find something else that's going on there. And then if they really have trouble, then I start pointing things out to them, and their eyes go wide, and they say, wow, I didn't know there was so much in the story. So stories. So it's the responsibility of you, if you want. You can take a story really far, or you can go really a short distance by just saying, forget that story. So the story of the Buddha. So one story is that the Buddha lived a life that was very closely connected to nature. He was born under a tree. A pivotal turning point in his life as a young child was sitting under a tree when he was 6 years old. He spent long periods of time living in the wilderness, and then he was enlightened sitting under a tree. As a teacher, he spent a long time in nature, natural world of India, walking. And when he laid himself down underneath two trees and died there peacefully under the trees. And for Buddhists, this idea that the Buddha was connected to nature and to trees is important. part of the story of the Buddha living this way, being close to nature, and is a story of a life of simplicity. People get turned off if you tell the story, it's the life of renunciation. But you can say it was a life of simplicity. And there's something very, you know, I just spent a few days camping with my kids. It's really beautiful to be away from everything in society and TV and computers and all this stuff. And just to spend enough days to kind of let all that drop away and just live in the simplicity of nature. And what is it about the story of living in nature, being connected to nature, being, you know, that is a meaningful story? For me, it's a story which I'm inspired by, meaningful for me personally. I like hearing the story of the Buddha being close to nature because it speaks to me of a simplicity of being. I don't need a lot of stuff. I don't need homes and cars. I don't really need these things to be happy. I can be happy very simply. I don't need a lot of stuff. The Buddha didn't know this when he was a young man. And the story is that his father kept him entertained by all the kind of music and courtesans and dancers and sports and all kinds of things. And he also kept him somewhat secluded from the world around him and supposedly from nature around him, the wider nature, the wilderness of nature, by keeping him fairly sequestered in the three palaces that his king, the father, had. So here's a life that was not connected to nature. So you can feel sorry for him or say, big deal. But you don't have to go very far from IMC into our community in this area of the world and encounter people, maybe some of you, who spend almost no time in nature. Not only spend very little time in nature, but are protected from it. Nature deficit syndrome is now a syndrome for children. Children don't spend enough time in nature. But it's not just nature that people are protected from. The first time that I saw a dead body, a dead person, was I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was a child. I think it was a young girl, young teenage girl, I believe, wrapped up in a blanket, being carried by a group of people down to the riverbank in Kathmandu to be cremated. I was 11 years old. And until that time, I'd never seen a dead person. I didn't see a dead person again until I was about 28. Kind of remarkable. Some people can't imagine something like that. But I know someone here at IMC who didn't see a dead person until she was 45. And that was only because she was in the chaplaincy program and she did a little bit of chaplaincy. She did chaplaincy volunteer work at a local hospital. And then you end up in the emergency room. And then you end up with people who are dead. So how many people grow up in our society protected from nature? One of the stories Buddhism tells is that dying, birth and death, is part of nature. And if you're connected to nature, you're part of that, you're connected to that. But there are plenty of people who live isolated, not only from death, and we protect it, we don't have it public, like it's not walk down the streets carrying the corpses, like they did in Kathmandu. But, you know, we kind of keep it off to the side. Or, you know, how many people live in communities where they're not aware of the tremendous amount of poverty in this country? Or how many people, you know, just keep it at a distance? Or the people who struggle in many ways? So the idea of living a life that's somehow isolated from a lot of what goes on in the wider world, I think is a very common one in our community, in our extended community. Children grow up that way. Living in the suburbs, or wherever, living. Some people are protected from it or isolated from much of nature because they live in the inner cities. that they're struggling, they're poor, and there's gunfire and all kinds of things going on around them. But they also don't have a chance to go there. They have nature deficit. They don't see the wider world. They don't, you know, I've read of people in the inner city who, someone took them to the ocean. They never seen the ocean. Someone takes them to Sequoia to see the parks up. And it's just, you know, they're just blown away. They can't imagine something like that. They're familiar with alleys and sidewalks and drug deals and things. So what are we not connected to? So the Buddha wasn't connected as a young man. That's the story. So what do you do as a young person, young in his 20s, grew up living a life that's isolated and not connected, and not connected to the wider world? He wasn't connected also to the wider society. He didn't see sickness, old age, and death, is what the myth says. So what do you do when you get a wind of how limited your life has been? What do you do when you realize that your life is, you know, doesn't really see all of life, doesn't include everything, doesn't include all of you? What do you do when you realize your life hasn't really faced and dealt with the existential issues that every life sooner or later has to deal with? I know a man who's 81, 82, I think. I try occasionally to, because of his age and my role, to bring up the idea that, you know, there might be some interesting usefulness to discuss, plan for your death, prepare for that. And he refuses. He's not going to go there. And it just seems 82, you know. You know, it seems like it's a natural thing and to have some discussion about it or some preparations or something. And you know, it seems kind of odd to just kind of shut down and resist that to me. But maybe that's the story I live in, that he lives in a different story where it's better not to address it or look at it. But so the Buddha was such a person who was, you know, hadn't dealt with these issues. The way the myth goes, the story goes, that one day he occurred to him to leave the palace and go explore the world a little bit. And he went out with his charioteer and the chariot. And to his surprise, they saw a person that he never, kind of person he'd never seen before. So he asked the charioteer, and said, "Who's that? What's that?" And he said to the charioteer, said, "Oh, that's an old person." "Really?" And that's an old person. And then the charioteer said, "That's the nature of everyone, to get old." And so then they went further on and they saw another kind of person. And they said, "Who's that? What's that?" And "That's a sick person." And, "Really?" Tiritir says, "The nature of everyone, sooner or later, to get sick." And then they saw a dead person. And the Buddha said, or he wasn't the Buddha yet, he was Siddhartha. He said, "What is that?" And he said, "That's a dead person." And that got the Buddha's attention. Today I talked to one of these people that we trained in chaplaincy, who spent a year doing the hospital residency that's required to become a professional chaplain in hospital. And he wasn't prepared so well, I think, or he was just surprised that this was his encounter with what in Buddhism is called the heavenly messengers, sickness, old age, and death. And he went through the list for me, what happened, the deaths that he was present for the first 3 days that he was started work in the hospital a year ago. And they were not like, you know, romantic, beautiful death, 99-year-old person who just said, "I'm ready. I'm ready to go, and thank you very much, and, you know, hold my hand." And that's not the deaths that he had, not because it's an emergency room. So you know, it's pretty dramatic. So for him, it was day after day, the heavenly messengers. And he feels that he was transformed by this experience, and he's never going to be the same. It was his, and in a good way. I mean, this really showed him something, had him face something about life. So for his story, the way he takes this Buddha story of the heavenly messengers, of the Buddha leaving the palace, where he says, "Yes, this was my experience of doing this. I left the protection of my life, and I encountered something very profound about human life that It's definitely part of it, but few people see. Few people spend that much time in the hospital emergency room seeing what really goes on there. So what is it? So you can tell the story to yourself. You can ask the story, you know. Have you seen what's called the heavenly messenger of sickness, old age, and death? What impact has this had on you? What meaning? What kind of impact would you like it to have on your life? Would you like just ignore it? You know, you'd rather go surfing or whatever your equivalent is. You know, you don't have time for that. Or would you like to, is there some way of reflecting and thinking about these things in such a way that is really good for you and for others? It's helpful, it's meaningful, it's motivating. The story that's the heavenly messengers ends with the Buddha then seeing a fourth, sometimes called a sign in Buddhism, a fourth person. So the Buddha said again, who's that? And the charioteer said, that's a renunciant. That's someone who's left their ordinary, everyday life in order to find some peace, inner peace, some resolution, some come to terms with these issues of sickness, old age, and death. And the Buddha was really impressed that this person he saw, the renunciant, was really peaceful and calm. And that inspired him. So that's the fourth of the four, what's called the four heavenly messengers in Buddhism. And so then he left the palace. He left his wife and newborn child behind. A story that horrifies many people in the West. How could a man leave his wife and newborn baby? A little bit we are horrified because we see the story, tell the stories from the point of view of modern American life, where that means something specific for us. We don't know, 2,500 years ago in India, a different culture, different time, we don't know what that was about. The relationship in family, what it means to be a family, it's hard to know and understand what it has the same meaning as it has today, leaving a family. But also, maybe he had no choice, living the protected, isolated, not real life that he was living. The way I tell the story of the Buddha leaving the palace was not a story of leaving his family, of leaving the world, but it's a story of entering the world. The Buddha was not in the world, protected in his palace. And at some point, it was untenable to keep living not in the world, not part of the world. And it was a courageous act for him. It wasn't so much renunciation that he did. It was that also. But he entered the world. And how many of us don't enter the world? How many of us hold back in some way, protected, afraid, attached to what was important for us? So in some ways, our life maybe is not as full as it could be. We haven't entered the world as deeply or entered something deeply. And so here the Buddha, that's a story. The Buddha and then entered the world. And I think it's also a story of a young man, young person, who has to leave home. I think that pretty much in our society, in many societies, we grew up, and sooner or later, the task is to leave home. And then what does it mean to leave home? And there are people who leave home but don't really leave. And there's not a few parents who are surprised how much their children don't leave. Even when they're living somewhere else. And what does it mean to leave home and to grow up and to mature and establish oneself? Does it mean a certain degree of autonomy and independence? And how many people actually do that in a full, complete way and find their autonomy, their independence? How many people really leave behind their security to deal with these deeper issues? So it's stories, right? We're just telling stories. So then the Buddha went off and to explore these issues. And what he did was he went around and picked up, went to study what the wise people of his time were teaching. So that's a reasonable thing. But he went and found the wisest people he could find, spiritual people. And he took on their practices and their approach. Their approaches. He tried a variety of different things. And some of them had to do with deep, deep stilling of the mind into kind of trance-like states. Some of them had to do with asceticism and self-mortification. And it says that he went as far as you can go in these different ways, going into trance, going into self-mortification. And at some point he realized that the answers and the peace and the engagement to the world that he was looking for, the freedom he was looking for, could not be found this way. And then he remembered a story. And the story was from his youth when he was 6 years old. And his it was the springtime. And his community did a ritual celebration or a ritual of the first ritual plowing of the spring season. It was a festive event. And his father, who was a king, something like that, presided over this. But being 6 years old, he was kind of like not in the middle of this celebration. It wasn't an important part of it. So he sat down under a rose apple tree at the edge of the fields. And he was forgotten there. They were off in the fields doing the ritual plowing. And he remembered that when he sat there alone, left alone, peacefully, no one wanting anything or doing anything, that he sat there peacefully and he became really peaceful. And a certain kind of joy rose up. And that memory of this childhood joy and peace became a reference point for him and how he then found his enlightenment, the freedom. And perhaps I think it's not uncommon, maybe not super common, but I'm not saying that everyone has this, but for people to remember, to have experiences when they were children that are touchstones, that are memories, that was really good. There are people who have bad memories as children that are touchstones, but there will also be positive things. For me, there were a number of ones that I had that became touchstones, that became more important as I learned to meditate. In fact, one of the experiences I had, I didn't remember until I started meditating, recovered memory. and it kind of because meditation kind of brought me into the same experience, and it was good. And maybe because I had it as a kid, it was good. And it was I can't probably explain to you what this experience was, but I had a word for it as a kid. The phrase, the expression of this experience was the edge of the pillow. And it was an experience I felt when I was going to sleep at night and I put my head in the pillow. And it was a feeling of being really complete, whole, settled, like everything was right. And I didn't think about it much as a kid, I just had it. And then when I started meditating, it came back. Oh yeah, I'm having that again. This is meaningful, this is, you know. Or when I grew up in this town, I talked to you earlier, I went back to in Italy. I used to take the bus to school, public bus, buy a ticket and all that. And for a while I noticed that, so it was in the old days, you know, I'm old now for me, but you know, this is 50 years ago now, right? I used to, they had a conductor and a bus driver on the public bus. And the bus driver's job was only to drive the bus, and the conductor's job was to sell the tickets. And he sold one-way tickets, round-trip tickets, children's tickets, senior citizen tickets, you know, all kinds of tickets. And he had different color tickets for the different things. And I lived at the end of the bus line almost. And we got near the end of the bus line, there were no one more with people getting on the bus. He would sit in a particular place in the middle of the bus and bring out his ledger. And he would do very carefully record all the different kind of tickets he sold to keep records of it. And I discovered that if I sat in the seat right behind where he sat and watched him do his ledger, very focused and careful, I would feel really good. That's all I knew. I was a little kid, right? I'd feel really good just watching it. And when I started meditating, I realized what was going on. I was getting concentrated. I was getting kind of zeroing in and focusing. My world was disappearing. There was that thing. So these are simple stories. There's a lot of stories, you know, people can have. But here the Buddha remembered something when he was a child. A child experience became the doorway to his enlightenment, to this great spiritual tradition. You know, you can get a PhD in Buddhism. You can, you know, you can read books and tomes of books on Buddhist philosophy and, you know, all this great stuff. And the Buddha's doorway into this realm was a child's experience of well-being. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that a nice story? Maybe it's not so difficult. And so with his experience of joy and well-being, he said, that's a joy and well-being that's reliable, that's maybe useful. It's not dependent on wealth and sensuality and status and all the things people search for in the world for well-being and happiness. It doesn't depend on things in the world. It feels like a good, it's healthy and clean. In ancient India, the idea of clean happiness or joy was a really important one because there was a big, big mistrust of sensuality in some of the spiritual traditions of India. And the idea that you can have joy and happiness was some people in the ascetic traditions kind of mistrusted. And so the idea that there could be this clean or pure kind of inner joy was very meaningful for him. And so then he sat down under the Bodhi tree in order to re-experience that kind of well-being and joy. And as he started allowing himself to have that well-being and joy sitting under the Bodhi tree, that led him deeper and deeper into a particular kind of meditation experience where the experience was more and more sublime and peaceful kind of happiness and joy and equanimity. And he found that when he got to the pinnacle of equanimity and peace that this kind of this took him to, that it gave him an ability to see, to understand his life in a way that he couldn't see it or understand it when his mind was more busy than active. And he saw something very deep about the processing of the mind, the heart. And in seeing how what he saw is also very simple. It's a story, and the story is called the story of the Four Noble Truths. The story is, the Buddhists love to tell this story, the story of how that if you cling, that clinging will bring you suffering. And if you let go of that clinging, that suffering will go away. That's a story, right? That's a story people have found really useful. How do you live in that story? You live in that story by finding out if that's true for you and how it's true for you. So what he saw, and he needed a mind that was really peaceful and equanimous to see kind of in the deepest roots in the mind. The way the Buddhists tell the Buddhist stories is they love the word roots. It's a metaphor, right? But there's these deep roots in the mind, meaning that you can't see them on the surface of the mind. You don't see it in the flowers and the plants of the mind, but you have to go deeper into under the soil in the mind to see the roots. And that's why this deep meditation the Buddha discovered is so useful, because it gets you down into the roots. And then he saw the simplicity of clinging and the release of clinging. And in doing that, he became free. Free from clinging. Free from continuing this process of holding on and grasping that is such a common part of human minds. So the story goes on. The next thing he did, within a short time, was he started teaching this to other people. This is a story of a man who then had compassion for others. And then in his simple lifestyle of living, walking around India, he went around for 45 years, not living in, you know, enlightened retirement. Exactly, you know, just sit there and, you know, be enlightened and pick your nose, you know, under the shade of the tree. But rather, he went off and wandered around, met people, received people, taught people, was engaged in the world. Remember, he left the palace, in my story, to engage in the world, to be in the world, and then he stayed in the world that way. It's a beautiful story, I think. The story of compassionate service and care of the world. And then, when he was 80, 81 years old, the way the story goes, was he was walking back to his home country. Why he was walking back to his home country at such an old age, probably frail, we don't know. The Buddhist texts don't say, but he was walking home. I'm kind of touched by this. You know, it's kind of like this humanity going home one last time. he didn't make it. It's kind of nice. You know, there's a tendency in certain religions, all religions, to idealize their founders. And actually, the further away you get from the founder, the more hagiography there is, the more the myths are built up and more perfect the person is. If he was really perfect, maybe he would have made it home. If his life was perfect, everything went well. But it didn't work out that, even there. He didn't make it home. But he knew he was dying. He laid himself down on the ground, and he gave his last teachings to his monks, his students. And then he closed his eyes, and he went into meditation. And this childhood experience that he had of well-being and peace that he had as a child, he brought that on again. And what he learned from that, to go deeper into the mind, he then went deeper into it. And when he reached that place of great equanimity and peace, stillness, that had been the doorway to enlightenment, to his great insight, that's when he passed away, peacefully. That's the Buddhist story. And for Buddhists, that's, I think, you know, so what do you want to do with that story? Do you want to do anything with the story of the Buddha dying peacefully? Is that a nice story? Is it a meaningful story? I probably don't have to tell you that there are religions in the world where how the founder of the religion died is like a central part of the story. I mean, like, that story is like, the religion doesn't exist without that story, right? So it's possible to take the death of a founder and make it into a really important part of the religion. You know, and it's so, what about the death of the Buddha? Can that be a really important part of the religion for Buddhism? How he died? Maybe it's a myth he died that way, but what is that? What kind of myth, what kind of story, what kind of lessons, what kind of theology can you grow and develop and live with the story of a teacher, a spiritual teacher, who died peacefully under a tree? Is that meaningful? So how do we live with these stories? Are these stories meaningful? How can they be repeated? How can we find ourselves in the stories? How can they reflect our own life? They don't have to. You don't have to have these stories at all. But what people have found is that revisiting these stories, living with them, reflecting on them, talking to them, telling yourself these stories, finding yourself in these stories, finding the stories in your life, is one of the ways to deepen a spiritual life, a religious life. Because story making is part of what is part of the path, part of the enrichment, part of the depth, part of the, speaks a little bit more to the fullness of the human heart and the mind and what goes on, our processing, than reading really abstract books about the 32 kinds of emptiness in Buddhism. Or the 108 kinds of consciousness. You know, you can, it's interesting to do those things, but you know, you can go through the lists. I think it's 127 kinds of consciousness. So we'd be here for a while if I went through it all, listed all of them to you. You know, but to tell a story, you know, so I offer that to you to tonight. The importance of story and living in story and living with, playing with story. And it's really important for religious people, I would say for Buddhists, a way of deepening and enriching your life. There's many stories in Buddhism that are very valuable. And one of the stories that we tell, or Buddhists might tell, is not only would they say that stories are important because they tell a lot of stories, but one of the functions of stories is to be able to take you beyond the stories. The stories that help you drop all the stories. So I'm sure there are stories that you carry with you that are not for your betterment. And it's really a wonderful, wonderful thing to have the stories that can help you put down all stories, even if it's just temporarily. And that's one of the, and you know, that's one of the goals of Buddhist practice, is at least to have the experience once in a life where your stories are completely put down. Every single last one of them. And who are you when there's no stories to tell about yourself? So I hope this was interesting and useful. And I guess that really depends on you. No. Thank you.